Okay, are you there, Steve? We're doing this a remote today.
Ah, that's right, Scott. I'm here, and we want to welcome everybody to the International Equine Network's Flying Turns, our harness racing show.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Steve, we would go a long way back to 96 when we first started doing this project. And now, you know, we've made some headway and we're getting there. And, you know, what we'd like to do is start talking about, you know, the harness industry, you know, educate people. You've been to all these tracks, so why don't you pick a track and start telling us?
Pick a track. One of my favorite tracks was actually in my hometown of Flemington, New Jersey, and Fairwind Farms, that was the breeders. East Lynn Farm had a half mile track, used to have the New Jersey Sire Stakes held there. And one year we had a 2 year old filly, trotting filly, who was really good. Name was Wolf's Jaffa, named after an old city in Israel. But what happened was we trained on that track all the time, so our filly was good. But, you know, when that train came by halfway through the race, the mother two-year-old fillies in the race didn't want to cooperate. And she ended up winning by, like, 9 lengths because the other ones couldn't stay on stride.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of New Jersey up there, we started out at Freehold up there. You know, that's a great track. You know, it's been there forever, and it seems to always get a pretty good crowd.
You know, it had a disastrous fire in 1984 that burned the entire grandstand to the ground. But before that, it was truly the afternoon delight. And they ended up, they would have 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people on a weekday and 7,000, 8,000 on, you know, on a Saturday afternoon, 10,000, which on a steady basis, it was a lot of money being bet.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, like when we did the Flying Turns from there and we were going to Sonic test it back over to Eastern Europe, they wanted to make sure that we didn't show a lot of good looking girls and a lot of money there, and that's going to be hard to do because, you know, it was packed and everything.
Oh, it was. Even after the fire, when the track raced in the tennis, indoor tennis bubbles that they purchased, and then when the new track opened, things got even better. They drew in more. We brought in more Grand Circuit stakes. We held a few Breeders' Crown races there. We had special events like chili cook-offs and, you know, other family fun stuff. And we still were drawing 4,000 and 5,000 people a day. It was great.
It just goes to show you, you know, that there are good horse people around and good entertainment, you know, to go to it and everything. And one of the things that I was thinking about was, you know, all these tracks that are all around the United States. Who governs those tracks? You know, is it individual states or, you know, is there an organization that governs those tracks?
Well, there is. In the United States, it's the United States Trotting Association, or the USTA, as everyone calls it. They not so much govern, but they set up the rules and regulations that the tracks should abide by. Do they all do what they say? No, but for the most part, at least they have the rules and regulations set forth. And then each state's racing commission uses the USTA rules for, you know, governing, and then they might slip in some of their own. But the USTA is also keeps all records, all the charts, all the race information. Of course, they have their website that provides all the news of what's going on, the entries, results, everything. A plethora of information you can, you know, just get on there. And when you're a diehard racing person, then they also have what is called Pathways, which is where you can go in and look up individual horses and all their records and achievement. And it's quite an operation.
Well, I noticed on there, like Harness Link and HarnessRacing.com and Standard Bread of Canada, Daily Racing Form. You know, there's so many, ways to find out about the harness industry. I hope that our listeners can go to IENTV.org, so they can start checking some of these things out. But it's unbelievable some of these websites they have, what they have on them.
And, especially with our international equine network, there's harness racing around the world. So if you want to know about harness racing in Australia, in New Zealand, they have, each country has major websites. In France, it's the Le Trot, website. In Sweden, it's the AGT. Harness Racing New Zealand, Harness Racing Australia. Even in the little island of Tasmania off the Australian coast, they've got big harness racing there.
But, you were telling me a story here back in the summer about, in Bermuda? That they
yes.
Yeah, what was that young man's name?
Kiwan Waldron. And Rene Allard saw him in Bermuda. They race what they call standardbred ponies there. They're just, smaller horse versions. They only can have four horses in a race. But apparently he saw this young man and thought he was great and invited him to come up and race on the Quebec Fair Circuit. And the kid went up there and scored 18 wins to, lead all the drivers up there. And then finally got to be able to drive pari-mutuelly at the Hippodrome 3R in Quebec. And on the fair finals day, he won three races. I mean, this young man wants to come back and be a professional driver, and apparently he's going to get Rene's backing, which means a lot because he did that for another driver a couple of years ago by the name of Louis-Philippe Roy. And Louis Roy is now one of the top drivers in all of Canada.
Well, that's the whole thing about flying turns. We're going to start talking about things like this, and you're getting ready to leave us and go over to France for some racing, aren't you?
Oh yeah, I'm getting lucky. One of my main clients is for the last 7 years is HarnessLink.com. John Curtin is the founder and owner of the website, and HarnessLink covers racing around the world. And I've got a team of reporters and photographers coming with me. One of them is Heather Vitale, who many of you know, who's great on Facebook. She's the social media diva of harness racing. I also have another Harness Writers member, Sarah Thomas from Scotland, who's going to come and do the photography. And of course, I'll be doing the writing, and we're going to Paris at the end of January for the 1 million euro Prix de Mérique, the richest harness horse race in the world.
Now that's in January?
Yes, that's January 26th. Sunday the 26th is that big race. And if you've got to get up a little early if you want to see what's going on, but you won't have to worry about it because we'll be covering it and feeding it and sending everything up live on Facebook with Heather Vitale, and then, of course, in writing and with photography that I'll get taken care of.
Well, maybe we can get you on Flying Turns on our video project that we're going to be starting in January. And also, that ought to be pretty good.
I think you ought to put a GoPro on my head.
There you go. We'll do that. Speaking of France, the horse sales are coming up, and I think it's phenomenal how many horses are sold, like at the Black Book sale or the mixed sales that are coming up. And what just blows my mind is how they get all the way around the world. Some of them get bought in Pennsylvania or New Jersey, and then they send them over to Europe and everything. Are the sales doing good for the standardbred industry now?
Well, 2019 is going to close out with one of the greatest years for the horse sales, especially the yearlings. Record prices were paid, $1.1 million for a trotting colt by the name of Maverick, another $1 million for another trotter. The average prices for all the sales in Ohio, the sales in Lexington, the sales in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, all saw record numbers this year. So there's money being spent, that's for sure.
Well, you know, here at Sunshine Meadows, where we're doing our show from, and one of my other jobs that I work here, we're filled up here. We've got people like Casey Coleman has come in. Tony Alanya brought the Maverick in. You know, it's just amazing that they come here. And we see all these horses that are being broke and, you know, start into training. And then, you know, in July and August, we start seeing, you know, a lot of these horses win. We had the Hamiltonian winner here from a few years ago, Atlanta. She was broken trained here, you know, that type of thing. So, you know, it's important, you know, to go to those sales, you know, and get those nice horses. Do you see any new money or is it old money?
Well, we're seeing new money and a lot coming from Europe. And I know there's a lot of people out there that say, oh, yeah, these Europeans, they're coming in, they're buying everything up, they're winning races, they're taking money, you know, out of the United States. But they're totally wrong, because the Europeans realize that the stake season, let's say from May to November, is chock full of races here. And they're buying American horses, and they're having them broke and race here in America. And in some cases, yeah, they take them back to Europe, but it's been an unbelievable year. So there's old money, there's definitely new money. We also have the age now of fractional ownership, where someone like Anthony McDonald, Renee Allard, other people out there are selling pieces, small pieces of their horses, sometimes $300, $600 to get, you know, a percentage of a horse. But it's also drawing a lot of new people. And those that are having success with it, of course, they're saying, wow, this is great. And they're telling their friends about it, and they're coming in and buying more horses. So I really see an upsurge.
You know, here at Sunshine Meadows on Saturdays, we have On the Deck. And what it is Myron Bell and some other people have gotten together and they're syndicating horses. And I see an awful lot of new faces, you know, out here every Saturday, you know, taking a look at these horses that were purchased in the sales. You know, it was unbelievable, you know, to see that.
Oh, no. And we're going to this year for sure, when the deck, I guess, I'm sure, is open by now, and everyone's coming down for the winter. But we're going to probably be able, just at Sunshine Meadows, to see some of the greatest trotters and pacers for the future. I mean, these they're now actually yearlings, but they'll be two-year-olds in a couple weeks. They're definitely going to see a few of them that are going to be the world champions.
Well, you know, just to let our listeners know out there, at Sunshine Meadows we have show horses and we have riding horses. And, you know, of course, our main business is the standard bred. And a guy asked me the other day about Sunshine Meadows, and I said it's one of the few places that the public can come out and visit, like the On the Deck, where you see past champions, you see present champions, and you see future champions all at one spot. And that's exactly what we're doing here, you know, and I hope some of our listeners would come out and visit with us.
That's right. Anyone is invited, usually around 8 a.m. is best, unless you work in the, only want to see the Casey Coleman horses go, then you better be there by 7 o'clock, whether the sun rises or not, because she's out there working.
Her first set goes out at 12:01 a.m.
Yeah. Hey, tell me, when breaking, that's not the right word, training these young horses and working with them, it's not an easy thing. And apparently Casey Coleman had one that gave him a little trouble last week.
Oh, yeah, she did. I can't remember the gentleman's name, but Brandon Mills, our general manager, is a former professional bull fighter, and he knows a lot of people, you know, on breaking horses and getting horses trained. And it was kind of funny. This gentleman had never, you know, worked with a standard bred, but he came out here, and in 2 days' time, Steve, he had this horse ready to go to the bike. You know, it was just, you know, it was amazing, the turnaround. And that's one of the great things about out here is we have so many people that have knowledge and have access to any problem you might have, you know, and that's exactly what they did. And from my understanding, the horse is doing very well.
Yeah, I think the term they call it is gentling.
Gentling, and, there you go.
Yeah, there you go, and that takes care of it. But I also know sometimes they don't like it, and when they go out for the first time, they can kick, buck, and spin and strike, and they
well,
used to have
lay
wooden
down on the track and not get up.
Yeah,
but you get them off in the grass, back to the barn, and they're just as nice as they can be.
They're like spoiled little kids.
Hey, I got a good one for you, and I thank you for giving it the information to me. On IEN, we have a movie of the week, and it was from 1948. Now, I know you weren't around then, but you do like that movie. Is that your favorite movie?
It is one of my all-time favorite movies, because growing up, I knew about harness racing, but I wasn't, you know, participating yet. My father would take me to the fair races and to Freehold once in a while. But we used to watch together a movie called Green Grass of Wyoming, from 1948. And yeah, it's one of my favorite horse movies of all time.
Yeah. You know, I tell you, if you go back and look at some of those movies and look at the equipment, you know, from, well, like then in 1948, and then you see it today, it's a big change for the standard bred industry and the horses.
Unbelievable. Yep.
It's amazing what they did. You know.
But let me tell you, that movie was pretty popular too, because on our, if you go to the International Equine Network Facebook page, you'll see that's where we have it. And then of course set up on the website, but just alone from the Facebook page, I guess we're at almost 4,400 views. So the movie obviously is pretty popular. And I know that every week on IEN, our movie of the week is getting anywhere from 4,000 to 6,000 views. It's a great thing. And people, go ahead.
You know, they're good family movies, you know, and that's what we're trying to bring back at IEN, show how, you know, the horse industry, no matter what breed you're in, you know, that it's a good family type thing. And, you know, like the standard bred business, I remember, you know, the kids getting their faces painted. You know, they had little mini carts, I believe.
The mini horses, yeah.
Right. You know, and the kids just love that, you know. And what I liked about the mini horses is they were scaled to the size of the kids that were riding. So they didn't feel like, you know, they were going to get trampled by a big horse. You know, that was something they could relate to. That was
no, and those mini horses, they're great because unlike a pony, they're so gentle and they never get, you know, too wild or anything, and they don't really bite, and the kids can play and do with them. But they were actually used in Great Britain and Scotland in the coal mines, because they could fit in, and these little mini horses, they may weigh 200 pounds, but they were able to pull carts with as much as 400 pounds in it, and that's why they were used and bred to be small like that. So an adult can actually get in a cart behind a mini horse, and that thing will just take off with them. They're unbelievable.
Yeah.
Good animals. I'll tell you one. We had a match race at Pompano Park, between the leading driver, the all-time leading driver, Bruce Ranger, went against Jake the Snake Roberts.
Oh, man.
And that mini horse, they raced down the track. Jake the Snake was pretty good. He came out and practiced, and he lost by a nose to Bruce Ranger. But it was still that a guy that big, 300 pounds, could a mini horse just goes with him.
Yeah, you know, that's the amazing thing about the horses. Most people think of, you know, horse racing as, you know, the thoroughbreds and, you know, the small jockeys. But I've noticed in the harness industry, a big old guy like me can get behind one of them and still be a winner and don't have to weigh 110 pounds.
No. The essence is that, you know, it's more of dragging instead of having someone sit in the back. And it's sort of like the rickshaws, you know, the old-time rickshaws. The little Asian person was able to pull two or three people in a cart, you know, without a problem. Yeah. And the same works in harness racing. I mean, with the drivers, it's the skill. The majority of the drivers that do the best are maybe 145 to 170 pounds. Which I don't think any jockeys could ride at that weight, could they?
Oh, no, heck no. Well, you know, Steve, I think that, you know, a lot of things that we're trying to show, you know, and tell people about on our programming at Flying Turns, you know, we've talked about over in Europe, you know, the richest race in the world. You know, we're talking about, you know, racing here in the States. You know, like, for example, the Breeders' Crown. You know, a lot of people don't, you know what that is. And it's compared to, like, the Breeders' Cup for the Thoroughbreds. Where is that Breeders' Crown going to be at this year?
This year coming, it's going to be back at Hoosier Park in Indiana, right outside of Indianapolis. And let me tell you, 2 years ago, they held the Breeders' Crown, and people said it was one of the greatest nights ever. But it's always a great event. This last year was at Mohawk Raceway. I mean, the Breeders' Crown is international between being, you know, depending on where it's being held. But Hoosier Park did an unbelievable job with it, and they broke all their records for handle and attendance the night of the finals.
Yeah, now that's on Dan Patch Avenue, isn't it, up there in Indiana?
Yeah, Everything around the racetrack is named after great horses, and that's a good thing to do. It's a good thing. But, yeah, I give the people at Hoosier Park major credit for what they do in hosting that big night. I mean, it's 12 championship races.
Yeah. Now, what about the Little Brown Jug? That's Ohio's.
Yes, that's in Delaware, Ohio. It is usually the third Thursday of the month of September, and it's stamped to be held that day. And believe it or not, in that whole Delaware County, they had the Delaware County State Fair going on then, and on Little Brown Jug Thursday, they actually close all the schools because everybody goes out there. 40,000-50,000 people they've had.
You know, when I first started getting interested in television and radio for the horse industry, I'd gone through up there, and I always heard about the Little Brown Jug, and I stopped to get some fuel. I was hauling horses to New York, and I stopped to get some fuel, and in the gas station, everybody, it was all Little Brown Jug. They had a Little Brown Jug from the size of a thimble to one up that was a five-gallon jug, you know, and the guy was telling me, he said, are you going to watch it? You can go to it. And I said, no, and I'm going to watch it on TV. And I saw an announcer, Haywood Halebrook. He was announcing from CBS, and he was interviewing people that would actually take a chain and lock their chairs to the fence around the track so they would have a spot next year.
That's right. They have a couple sections, and it's still done today. And what happens is if you can unlock that chair that you put up there, then that's your seat for that for the day's races. Because at that section, they'll be I would say 10, 15 rows deep of people watching the races, but they got their chair linked up to the fence, then that's where they get to sit.
That's amazing. Now, do they have anything like that when they have the Hamiltonian? That would be the next race that, I would think.
Oh, yeah. In the Triple Crown, yes. The Hamiltonian will not have a fare or anything like that. But if you don't, purchase your seat in advance, you may have to stand because they're going to get, anywhere from 20,000 or more people to come out for that big day, because that's usually like a Breeders' Crown, or in the jug days, we're talking about $4 to $6 million in purses.
That's one thing that I've noticed. The purses are getting a lot better, and you're seeing a lot creating some new races. Are there any new races that they're creating out there
The third biggest race, richest race in the all of harness racing, it's an old race, but it's been revitalized. The Yonkers International Trot. It's now in the third year of going for a purse of $1 million.
Yeah. Oh, wow!
And they also have. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Sorry about that.
They're going for $1 million. There is going to be a new race, I think, held in Canada for 2-year-old trotters. That's going to go for $1 million. And that is totally different than what's been done before, because they're actually selling the post positions, not the post positions themselves, but they're going to have 10 spots in the race plus AEs. And you got to pay about $110,000 to get one of those spots. And then once you have it, you can either, if you have a horse trotter eligible, fine. But if you want, you can actually sell it, or, you can put it up for auction and sell it to the next highest bidder to see who wants to get that spot.
Yeah. See, those are the things that, we're going to try to inform our listeners about and everything. But there's one thing I want to ask you about today. Today's a pretty big day in racing, isn't it? Isn't Wiggle and Jiggle It running tonight?
Well, there's a little bit of it. Yeah, there was a little bit of excitement. Wiggle It, Jiggle It. He was the 2015 Harness Horse of the Year, and he has made a comeback. He's a gelding, so it's not like he could retire to stud or anything like that. But he was he injured himself at the end of his 3-year-old season. Tried to come back at 4, no good. No good at 5. They kept playing with him at 6. Got a couple no starts in him. And then this year, the owner, George Teague Jr., and his son Montrell drives and Clyde Francis trains. They apparently may have him back because he's had 2 starts, and 2nd and the 3rd. He just won 2 qualifiers in a row, and he's the favorite today in the $25,000 open, or the day that we're taping this, at Dover Downs. He's a career winner of $3.9 million. So we're really hoping he can come back and race.
Well, it's good for the industry, to have those kind of horses, the older horses that stick around, that you can see run, a couple years in a row, 3 years in a row. It's good to have that for the business.
We had McWicket too for Casey Coleman. Now he's finally retiring the stud, and he's been a world champion. What a great gutsy performer!
That's just it. When you start looking at horses like that, you go back to looking at the breeding aspect of it and everything. So I know I'm jumping ahead of here a little bit, but the
sure.
breeding and racing is really big, for the clients out there, with the sales at Harrisburg and so forth. Do you find it's easier to try to breed a winner or to buy a winner?
Well, it takes a lot more money to breed a winner, I think, than it does to buy one, because the exceptional conformation and top breeding horses, obviously the best ones this year, were selling for $1 million as a yearling. And what are the chances of making it? You know, that's a tough call, but I think it's easier to buy one. I think if you're watch when these two-year-olds make their first start and you see someone that, you know, really looks either very good, then you want to try and see about purchasing them, because they're ready to go and ready to race. Also, it's going to be a return on your investment, and you're getting a horse that you know you've seen on the racetrack that's doing well.
Right. What I was going to ask you about is, how about Green Shoe and Courtly Choice? We just highlighted on the Clicket. But Green Shoe and Courtly Choice, they're going out to stud this year, aren't they?
They're going to stud. Lather Up is going to stud. These were all, of course, top three-year-olds. I wish they could stay and race a little bit more, but obviously... the idea of being able to breed, is much more lucrative. But there's one horse who's going to be a little different, Scott, and that's a horse by the name of Better's Wish, who won $1.6 million this year, 13 races. I mean, he's super well-bred. And what they're going to do is they're going to breed him to a limited number of mares this winter, and then get him prepped up to race next summer, which I think is a great way to go.
Yeah, now that's the trainer and co-owner, that's Chris Ryder, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's good. Maybe we could get Chris to get some more winners and keep them out there a little longer.
Well, he's going to do that, but I'm curious, because I know over in Europe, especially in France, one of the greatest racehorses and stallion is by the name of Reddy Cash, and he raced and bred for years, and now one of his sons is Bold Eagle, who won the Breeders' Crown this year, came over and led from start to finish, and he's already bred some top horses. I mean, I think this is something that the North America needs to look at a little bit more. But you tell me, Scott, is this done in the thoroughbreds at all?
No. Basically what it is the thoroughbreds, they race here in the States, and they try to stay in the States, that type of thing. Now, California Chrome, I think he's going to Japan. They're going to send mm-hmm. him over to Japan. Now, they will shuttle some horses back and forth, but it seems to take a toll on them, going to different hemispheres, and so forth. That's why I always thought, it was interesting about, the standard bred industry. I've seen Lindy Farm and the horses that they produce here. Wendback Farm was another farm that's, brings a lot of their horses here. That type of thing. And so it's kind of new to me to see them doing this. But, no, they don't do that too much in the thoroughbred business.
No, and I don't think in the quarter horse business either.
No.
But I just think that if it's the right kind of horse, I mean, if the horse is ending his three-year-old season and he's sound, and now he's going to breed 25, 30 mares, and in between, the breeding and stuff, they're still going to work with him on the racetrack. He's not going to slow down that way. And then they'll be able to have him, ready, when the weather turns for all the big races. I think it's the thing to do.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the things that I'm looking at is, down under in New Zealand or Australia.
Right.
Are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. I had a little lapse there. Down in Australia, or New Zealand, do they shuttle horses back and forth from, New Zealand to Australia or Europe or to the States?
All over. In fact, the Australia and New Zealand, I would say, import the most of any of their horses are most sought after, I think, because of the exchange rate on money and what they're going for. And they're coming by the plane load to the United States. I think that's the biggest movement you see of horses, and also of stallions, too. They'll ship stallions back and forth, as opposed to using frozen semen. They just bring the stallion over, which, you know, some horses do fine that way. That's a whole nother discussion. But the majority of horses that I know in the harness racing business, they travel throughout Europe, absolutely. I mean, it's very easy to go, not easy, just a long truck ride from Sweden to France and to Germany or Italy for the races there. Even to Budapest, Hungary, where they have a lot of harness racing. Every week they have race meets there. Yeah. So the but the most traveled horses are the ones from, they're bought in New Zealand and Australia and kind of come to America to race. And they do very well.
We've got
the number one.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, you were going to say, do they ship them on a truck from Australia? And I was going to say, no.
No, on our January show, we got Tim Duda that'll be going to interview about, he flies horses all over the world. And I used to fly with Instone Air Services, and it's quite a project, you know, to get them from one place to the other. It's just amazing how well they travel in the air. And then we're going to have Dr. Creech from Creech Brothers on, and he's going to talk about how they ship from the airport out to the different facilities, like here at Sunshine Meadows, you know, for training. And also, it's kind of amazing, you know, what these horses go through, and they still, you know, are able to win, whether it's France, England, Australia, or the States.
Scott, you've done this before. Is there first, second, and third class for shipping the horses?
Yeah.
I mean, in first class, do they get TV and champagne?
No. It's amazing. It's all the same for them. It would be nice to do that, for them. But they travel real well. They go go into a box of containers, 12 by 12, and they travel real well. And when I was with Instone, what we would do is we would bring water with us from the farm that we were leaving from, and we would bring, 10 gallons with us, and we would cut it into the water as they traveled so that they got acclimated to the water they were going to be getting, when they got here in the States.
Is this the same with feed and hay and stuff? Or?
Same with it. You split it up half and half. And it makes a big difference, in how they travel. But, for the most part, very rare, does it bother, that type of thing. They actually get bothered sometimes more on the ground than they do in the air because they've got so many things that they're looking at, that type of thing.
And we know with the Australian and New Zealand horses, when they fly into the United States, they usually turn them out in the field and then lightly start training them back. And they may not even try and race them for a month or two because that difference and, the idea of the traveling and all, these horses can get easily very, very sick until they're acclimated.
Oh, you're exactly right. And that's like, I guess it would stand, for any of the racing entities that are traveling horses like that. Sometimes with the thoroughbreds, you'll shock what they call shock a horse. If he's going to race on Saturday, you might want to fly in on Thursday. Same thing with domestic. If you fly in on Thursday and race Saturday, the chances of the horse coming down with anything or being affected by the trip is very minimal. But if you ship in a month beforehand, it gives them time to, catch something, it just depends on the horse.
No, I totally can understand that. But you know what's coming up, Scott? What time of year is it? Isn't it the holiday season?
You got that right. Ho, ho, ho.
And yeah. And during the and with the end of the year comes the end of the year balloting and voting for the horses of the year. And that is coming up big time here in the United States and Canada. In the United States, we have voting for the horses of the year in their respective divisions are done by the United States Harness Riders Association. They all vote, and then the race secretaries at all different tracks. So there's around 200 people that will be voting for the Dan Patch Award winners. And up in Canada, they'll have they're voting for the O'Brien Awards. And a lot of importance is relying on this what will be, I guess, a media blitzkrieg, because who knows who's going to be Horse of the Year or Trotter of the Year or Pacer of the Year.
Yeah, but you should have an inside view on that, because it's the Harness Sports Rider Hall of Famers that vote for that, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, all of them, all the members of the Harness Riders Association get the vote, plus the race secretary. So there's a lot out there. But
with you being a Hall of Famer, we got an inside scoop, do we?
I don't know. I have my picks done, and there's been a few years where I was 100% on the nose, but there's been some years where I wasn't as close as I thought I'd be. And people have to understand, there can be an outstanding great trotter and an outstanding great pacer. And when the voting ends up coming, they actually get so many votes for each other that another horse ends up getting Horse of the Year only because the other two split all the votes. And that actually happened in 2014 with a great filly, undefeated filly by the name of She's a Great Lady. And the two top other horses in the division each split the vote, and because she got about 56 votes out of the 200, she ended up being Horse of the Year, and she wasn't even voted Pacer of the Year.
Wow. Well, let me ask you, is there any horses out there that would be going for a back-to-back Horse of the Year?
McWicked, but I don't know what his chances would be. I mean, he had a good season, but there's some other horses. You know, he goes against Better's Wish, he goes against the Lather Up, he goes against Sharton N. I mean, they're all war. You know, it's a real toss up. I mean, how can I say it? I wouldn't be surprised who gets named Horse of the Year. But my selections in.
If they go to Harness Link, they'll be able to see harnesslink.com. They'll be able to find out who wins.
Oh, yeah. Well, what happens is the Trotter of the Year and the Pacer of the Year, and then finally the Harness Horse of the Year, they will not be announced until the night of the February 23rd, the big Dan Patch dinner is in Orlando, Florida, and it will be live on Facebook via the United States Trotting Association. So nobody's going to know the answers until to those questions. But all the individuals, the two-year-old, three-year-old, aged horse divisions, they'll all be announced right before Christmas.
There you go. Hey, speaking of the end of the year and Christmas and everything, what is going on up there at the Meadowlands? That New Year's Eve will have a mandatory payout that could exceed $250,000 to be paid out in their wagering up
there. Oh, yeah. There's
What's
there,
going on
there's,
there?
the high five, super high five, they call it, which I actually think Woodbine and up in Canada were the first ones to get going with it. Well, before that, it was a different name at Gulfstream Park. But yeah, the Super High Five, their pools are going to be gorgeous for the bettors to look at. There's actually one right now that I think on New Year's Eve is going to be paid out, and that's at the Meadows. where right now their super high five is over $100,000. And man, it may not get hit. And then New Year's Eve, it could end up, you know, being anywhere from $250,000 to $300,000. But you know, Scott, let me interrupt you here and tell you, we had a whacked out payout last week at Harrah's Philadelphia, and what kind of, you know, in a $14,000 trot, a roan gelding, which you don't see many roans in harness racing. His name is Paging Dr. Tio. He literally blew up the tote board at 108-1, but he paid 218 to win, 68.60 to place, and $224.40 to show. Now, we know why, and that's because the race favorite had finished fourth in the race, but it was an unbelievable payout. I mean, I couldn't, you know, I'd never really seen where the show payoff was so much higher than the win payoff, especially when you had a horse that was over 100-1.
Oh, that's unbelievable. Well, see, I just goes to show you, when you go there, every horse has his day, you know, and I guess that was his day or his night there. That's
right.
Phenomenal. Now, you know, all the tracks, do they have like a pick five, pick six, you know? Thoroughbreds, they got what they call the Rainbow Five, you know.
Exactly. Well, we have what they call a super high five, and it can vary from a dime to 20 cents a wager. And it takes a while depending on the track. A track like the Meadowlands, you know, they get a lot of handle coming in from all over North America. So, you know, their pool will get up there fast. And the same as, you know, with some of the thoroughbred tracks that, once people start playing into it and they know there's going to be a mandatory payout, the pools just, you know, blow up with money.
Well, I've noticed that at the thoroughbred tracks, when there's that mandatory payout and you're racing that day, you don't like to race on that day because, you know, there's an extra 3,000 people coming into the track.
Oh, yeah, they like that a lot. It's, what do you call it? It's, If you can get together, whether with people or something, and try and play as many different combinations as you can end up making a decent amount of money. I mean, the chances of just one person winning on a mandatory payout, I don't think that's ever happened. But we know that the Rainbow Six at the Gulfstream was actually hit right out by a gentleman.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing of it is, I was in Chicago at Hawthorne. We were running a stake race up there. And I went in my first time there, and I'm kind of looking around, seeing what the layout's like. And I went to get a soda and a hot dog, and there's an elderly lady there in front of me. And she was playing the pick four. And she was doing all kinds of wagering and gambling and everything. And so it was 20 cents to bet on four horses. And this poor lady, she couldn't hardly get up to the betting window, and I bet it for her, gave her a ticket. And she just started screaming and hollering. About 20 minutes later, she hit that pick four.
Oh, my gosh.
She bought five tickets and spent like $2.40, something like that. And it paid out $280, you know. So it just goes to show you that you never can tell what's going to happen in a horse race.
Oh, that's right. You're absolutely right. And what excitement, you know, literally for 20 cents. And if you're alive in the pick four, you could spend 20 cents and have a great adventure for a few hours.
Yeah. Well, you know, down at Gulfstream, they had a guy that was, he does gambling for a living. You know, that's what he does. And it was funny how it happened. It was at Freehold. He hit a trifecta. He was doing simulcast. He hit a trifecta at Freehold, and then he took that money and he put it back on, a superfecta at Gulfstream, and he hit that superfecta. And he said was literally almost broke. But, you know, at the simulcast, he knew a couple of horses running at Freehold, and they hit the board, and that gave him the money to go back to play, you know, the Superfect. And, you know, like I said, it's amazing how they pay out these tickets.
Oh, it is. It is.
You know, with the Horse of the Year coming up, is there anywhere that they can watch that live on TV? Do they have a program like they do, you know, for the Thoroughbreds?
Well, they do. It's recorded by the United States Trotting Association, so it's going to be live, but it'll be on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, there's one other thing I wanted to talk to you about here, and that's on the deck. That's a project that you and I started thinking about last year and everything. And I think for the listeners out there, they could come and visit, you know, us here at Sunshine Meadows and see how it could be very expensive to buy a horse, or from the syndications that they put together, it could be very inexpensive. And, you know, can you tell me a little bit more about On the Deck? You know most of those guys that are there.
Well, I know that the Antonacci family, that's been, you know, at Sunshine Meadows for a long, long time, they teamed up with the Tony Alagna and Myron Bell, and they had the former head of maintenance at Pompano Park, Billy Bigler, come out, and the deck right on the finish line, they had him rebuild that deck, and they furnished it. And now every Saturday morning they provide a breakfast feast from like 8 a.m. till around noontime, where you can come out and meet some of the greatest harness racing people in the sport and be able to talk and watch the two-year-olds in training perform and bullshit and talk about how great things were in the prior years and how great things can be in the future, and argue and talk trivia. I mean, it's fantastic. And even though I've been in the sport for 40 years, I can't hold a candle to Myron Bell or his brother Jeff or Ron Gerfein or Murray Brown. I mean, it's a fun Saturday morning.
I heard a story that they were telling one day, this group of them, and about a horse that had won. And, you know, they said the horse won by 6 lengths, 7 lengths, going away, did it easy. So I looked the horse up. The horse won by, you know, probably a neck. And it was a tight race the whole way, you know. But, you know, some 30 years later, you know, this horse had added 5 or 6 lengths to it. The pot had gone up on the purse, you know, $50,000, you know. And that's what I like about out here in Sunshine Meadows. It's a good place to bring your family, you know, to see things like this. You can see history, you know, out here. You know, you can actually see some of the greats of all time. You know, I was counting up one day. We had 5 Hall of Famers out here, you know, on one Saturday. And you know, it was just amazing, you know, to see and be around, you know, those type of people.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I know that every season David Reed has the people from Harness Racing Update come down. Now, David Reed runs the Lexington sales, and is probably one of the top salespeople there is in all of racing. And he puts on a champagne breakfast. Well, you can have champagne, you can have mimosas, you can have all sorts of things, and great food too. And usually those are the kind of days where we have 50, 60 people at the deck.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's one of the things that I like seeing, because the sport needs that. For a long time, the show horse industry has been real big in the social aspect of the show industry. You know, where you can go to Wellington, or you can go to Del Mar, or, you know, the Hamptons, and you can go and you can do things like that.
cal density. Perfect post-surgery. I've got proof that this works. Dramatic results, much faster than any other product. Cal density. It's what's inside that counts.